With recent research from Tourism Western Australia and Qantas finding out that over half of British folk have friends and or family who live abroad that they never visited, it's a really historic moment to actually find that Qantas are running direct flights from the United Kingdom to Australia, specifically Perth. And to address this, who better than that fantastic Renaissance individual, adventurer, author, television presenter extraordinaire, it's Simon Reeve. Hello, Simon.
Hello there. Renaissance individually. Thank you very much indeed.
Absolutely. We work on this whole process. It's all important to the whole side of things. Simon, always delight to touch base with your good self, but tell us about this particular phenomenon, really, that we talk about, obviously, people go abroad and so on, but it still seems, even in the 21st century, that when it comes to visiting, maybe people prefer to, well, we just use Skype, for instance.
Yeah, it's a great shame, really, isn't it? I was quite surprised by this research. As you say, Tourism Western Australia, Qantas, they've discovered that half of Brits have friends living abroad they've never visited. I was more surprised. 1 in 10 Brits have never met their aunt and uncle. Mm. I mean, it's slightly ludicrous, really, in an age when we're trying to connect with each other. We don't just want to do it digitally. We want to do it for real, as you suggest. And as if by magic, Qantas are going to make that happen. They're just starting to sell tickets now for the first flights ever. Aviation history, the first direct service from Europe to Australia, flights going to from London to Perth starting next year. Flight's going to take around 17 hours, which is a far cry from the first journey on the famous kangaroo route, which took 4 days and had 9 stops. So now you just hop on a plane, watch a few movies, and then you're in the far south in lovely Perth with all the delights of Western Australia and your family, hopefully, there as well.
You see, Simon, I was thinking you'd have to wait until the suborbital space shuttle effectively developed to actually get that routine. But no, it seems that you can actually travel just using the Boeing 787-9 Dreamliner, which also the good news from this point of view is you don't really have to panic about jet lag or indeed turbulence.
No, it's a fantastic new plane. I suppose it's a sort of it's a brand new plane that they've redesigned it, as well as I understand it, to make it slightly lighter so it can do this long journey. It will use 20% less fuel, I gather, which means 20% less emissions. You get slightly more legroom as well. What's not to like, quite frankly? And you're heading to one of the most wonderful parts of planet Earth. I think Western Australia is often overlooked by Brits, who tend to just focus on the cities in the far southeast. Mm. But Western Australia is a really extraordinary place. I've been lucky to go there a number of times while filming my documentaries. It's a vast part of the planet. If it were a country in its own right, not sure if you know this, it would be one of the 10 biggest in the world. And you know, it's home to some extraordinary wilderness areas. It's got incredible beaches, national parks, more than 100 national parks, 13 marine parks.
You've sold me, Simon. You've sold me.
We should go straight away.
Exactly.
Let's book.
The only mini challenge I can actually suggest is, surely, is it almost too comfortable? Because I know as a traveller, you actually think that the joy is in the travelling, not necessarily the arriving, the passage through that. I mean, I sense, Simon, you probably sort of still have a hankering to actually take the old convict journey by boat, perhaps.
No, I don't have a hankering to do it by boat. That is for certain. No, boats and me do not get on particularly well. I know what you mean. I think we don't want to lose the entire sense of an epic quest when we're off on our adventures. Yeah. I mean, what I would advise people, and not that it's for a TV presenter to do this, but I would suggest maybe, you know, you can have a comfortable flight there, but then make sure you get out and about and you have your adventures on the ground, on four wheels or by train. Obviously, there's an incredible train journey people can take across Australia as well. But just plan a proper adventure. Don't get stuck in one place. Make sure you actually see the place when you go there, because there is so much to see there. It's I feel quite defensive about Australia generally and Western Australia in particular, because I think people don't realise just how extraordinary and magnificent, quite frankly, it is. You know, people have long talked about Perth as a great place to live. It's a very livable city, a very pretty city. But it's also a great place to visit as well. It's a really dynamic city. It's got edgy parts. It's got cool bars. It's got great hotels. It's got, nine? I'm just racking my brain. Something like 9 city beaches, for goodness sake. So it's got loads going on there.
And although we've spoken about, obviously, meeting relatives and so on, presumably you say that as a holiday destination as well, as an opportunity to actually just explore part of the Southern Hemisphere, this is ideal, really, to actually get you directly there, with, which we said is 17 hours. I mean, it's less than a day.
Yeah, it really does. It is such a change from how people travelled in the past, isn't it? I mean, you talk about the convict journey, but you think back to the what people often call the golden age of travel, and you talk about the early kangaroo route that was the initial journeys that it took for people to get to Australia by plane. This is such a world of difference now, isn't it? We are living in what I think now is the golden age of travel, when people can get on a plane, travel to the other side of the planet in extraordinary comfort, and have adventures in amazing places. Like, one of my favourite in Western Australia is Karajini National Park, just between you and I. That's what I would really recommend when you're booking your next holiday. Karajini National Park. Go to Dale's Gorge, for goodness sake. And you look over the edge of that gorge and it's like looking into a lost world. It really is. It's an absolute Eden, with incredible red dragonflies the size of sparrows. I mean, it's just such an extraordinary place to go.
And of course, Qantas announcing the launch of new fares for the historic direct flights. Presumably, they won't be record-breaking fares. They will be affordable.
I think they probably will be.
Exactly.
Yes. I mean,
how can they find out? How can people find out about details like fares and booking details and information about this flight to Western Australia?
There is always a website, isn't there? There's Qantas.com. You can go on there and have a look at the prices and the tickets and work out when you want to go and how you want to get there. But I think there's just the little thing I would add as well is just to really encourage people to explore Western Australia and not just think of the better known parts of the country, perhaps in the south. East. You know, this is it's a really inspiring and beautiful landscape in Western Australia, and it covers such a huge area. There's always sunshine and summer somewhere in Western Australia, which is a little reminder to us at this moment in rather cold and grey blighty.
Well, it is our traditional British spring, you know, a little bit of frost on the morning. It's what we've turned to love. Clearly, a quantum leap forward for Qantas travel is the way forward from this perspective. I still have a hankering, though, for maybe actually going back to the days of the airship with a gondola. That'd be a lot more
airship with a
exactly.
gondola.
Yes.
Goodness
yeah,
me. But think how much that would have cost. To travel like that. People talk about that golden age of travel and they don't realise that it was an annual salary for most people to do these things. So what's on offer now is it's almost like the democratisation of travel. People can have incredible adventures and going to the other side of the planet, whether they're travelling to see their family, which they obviously should be doing, or whether they're travelling to bank loads of memories, which they should also be doing, and they can do it at a relatively affordable price. I mean, obviously everybody's different, but I think this is the golden age, and I think the fact that you can do these things is utterly extraordinary.
Simon, I always feel that the holiday season can never said to be have started in earnest until we featured your good self on an annual basis. It's been a classic connection as ever. A reminder, of course, that the Qantas route to West Australia, 17 hours, as they say, to actually get the non-stop journey.
17 hours and find yourself in Western Australia. What a thing.
It's a whole new world. Have you had a reasonably interesting and satisfying travel experience with us on the programme this morning?
It's been lovely. Thank you very much.
Simon Roof, many thanks indeed.
Don't know.
Challenge of becoming more experientially enhanced or chronologically gifted, or indeed just simply getting older, means that you have a higher risk of obviously suffering from dementia. And in fact, dementia directly affects around 800,000 people currently, with a further 670,000 carers obviously responsible in the UK. Lots of costs, lots of challenges. We are in the middle of Dementia Awareness Week, and to address hopefully some of the areas that can deal with dementia adventure and maybe actually offset some of the challenges of this challenging human condition, we're delighted to welcome Chief Executive Officer of Dementia Adventure, Neil Mapes. Neil, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Very well, thank you.
Excellent. So, Neil, clearly dementia has become something which has permeated our consciousness. There are a whole range of ways in which people are familiar with the challenges that are put together by the condition. But maybe it's not all doom and gloom from the perspective of what dementia is about, and in terms of outdoor activities in particular.
Yeah, I think what's happened in recent years and in the last decade in particular is that dementia's touched more and more families, and more people are aware generally of dementia, which is great. But also what we've also seen is an increasing amount of misunderstanding about dementia and potentially misrepresentation of people with dementia in the media. So there's a common understanding that dementia means that you've lost all your abilities and that you need care of a older person, potentially in a care home that's been abandoned in some sense. But and that can be the case for a small number of people, and we do need to support people in those scenarios as best as we can. But we've got a huge range of individuals living with dementia now. We've got a lot of younger people living with dementia, people in earlier stages that have been diagnosed really early in their disease progression. That can still do many, many things. You know, people still going on holiday, people cycling. We've taken people whitewater rafting, zip wiring. There's all sorts of things that people can do that are highly adventurous and traditionally adventurous in that sense, through to just simply connecting with the outdoors, getting out into a park or out onto your balcony or into the garden, so that you can start to experience the benefits of outdoor activity. And outdoor activity can be as simple as listening to the birds through to zip wiring and whitewater rafting and anything in between.
So what advice would you actually provide for somebody who might be listening to this, who might be a carer, who might be living with somebody who's got dementia? Because on one hand, you'd say, of course, get outdoors and so on. But sometimes it's not quite as easy as just somebody saying, well, get outdoors then.
No, that's exactly right. Yeah, it's quite a simple mission we've got at Dementia Adventure, is just to support people to get outdoors for the benefits that that brings. But actually, from the research that we did that was commissioned by Natural England, there's benefits to it, and we know that people are, their mood lifts, there's emotional benefits, and they certainly are physically healthier, and that you maintain muscle strength and reduce the likelihood of falls by staying active. And certainly people benefit socially as well by being with other people outdoors and maintaining their connections. But there's some real fundamental barriers, and there's multiple barriers that people face on a daily basis to enjoying those pleasures that many of us perhaps take for granted. So for example, lack of confidence. You know, people do lack the confidence to get out. There are genuine fears around safety concerns. They don't know what sort of welcome they're going to get when they go to a park or a green space or another venue to do with outdoor activity. And there's genuine problems with transport and mobility and support needs. So one of the things that we try and do at Dementia Adventure is to take our learning from our holiday provision and our short breaks and apply that to our training of organisations that we feel that could be doing more for people with dementia at a local level, particularly around outdoor activities. So we train those organisations to get past all those barriers.
Middlesbrough in the North East has received recognition as being a dementia-friendly town, and its intention to do that. It has cinemas which offer dementia-friendly screenings. Is this something else that obviously cities and towns across the UK could also be encouraged to do and obviously develop?
Yeah, certainly. And I'm a big supporter of the concept of dementia-friendly communities and dementia-friendly towns, society as a whole. I think my element of that I'd like to plug is the element of green spaces, of outdoor activity. When we look at dementia-friendly towns, banks and shops and buses and all those things are hugely important. But let's look at our natural environment, look at the natural assets that we've got in our local area, and how might people with dementia benefit from them. So that might be a farm, it might be a managed park, and it might be park rangers or volunteers in that green space, just linking up with a dementia organisation at a local level and saying, hey, you know, if we can have some training, if we can have some support, we'll love people with dementia to come here. And then that link has been made. So I think there's a focus needed on more opportunity and getting dementia out of the dementia world, so to speak, and having this more positive balance about what can be possible.
In terms of Dementia Adventure, again, from your own perspective, you already shared some of the exciting things that people can actually do from that perspective. Is there anything else you'd like to add as far as your own organisation is concerned?
Yeah, I mean, we're really grateful to have the support of organisations like the People's Postcode Lottery. They enable us to do innovative things, and we've supported a gentleman up in Scotland, for example, James McKillop. He went on a driving adventure with us. He hadn't been behind the wheel of a car for about 12 years, and he still calls that a world's first. There's people with dementia on a special interest group that we consult with on a regular basis, and Tim in that group has cycled up Mont Ventoux recently. There are such a variety and wealth of assets and abilities amongst people living with dementia. And that's our plea, really, in getting people to open their minds, to think differently, to think about what's possible, and to think about the outdoor environment that's on our doorsteps that we could use more effectively. There's a whole raft of resources on our website. You'll find research papers there and how we can train organisations if you find an organisation in your area that might need our support. But similarly, if you'd like to volunteer for supporting the holidays or need a holiday and you're in this scenario personally, or you know someone that is, do direct them to the website, which is dementiaadventure.co.uk.
Neil, we knew you'd obviously be a consummate professional with respect to that, and you've shared the address once again. We'll just mention it one more time for people to actually say, "This, I didn't quite catch it. We'll be played back the podcast, etc." The website once again is
dementiaadventure.co.uk.
Neil Mapes, Chief Executive Officer of Dementia Adventure. Many thanks indeed.
Thank you. We'll be right back.
Time now on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition for culinary class and gastronomic gorgeousness with the broadcasting legend, who is William Sitwell.
Quite right to the somber tones of Rachel Abbott there with the usual introduction for our ace guru of gastronomy. It's William Sitwell. Good morning, William. How are you?
That was a slightly different version.
Yeah, well, you see, we have lots of remixes. Then there are director's cuts, and then there's obviously CD bonus versions. It's all a case of the gradual sort of expansion of Sitwell mania that the world is gradually sort of being introduced to. Is there some wind going on where you're going? I thought the weather forecast today was another day which was going to be sunny and very dry, but no wind. Is there wind around you, William?
It's the speed in which the cycle.
Ah, that's it, you see. It's all marvellous stuff. So where exactly are you cycling?
I'm on, what is it, Gledstanes Road, West London.
Marvellous. So we can actually sort of put a full connection on that basis. Interesting enough, Jessica Ward sends her best. It's her very last day today. She dropped in earlier, couldn't stick around, because at this very moment in time, she's taking her very last journalism exam at the University of Lincoln. So there we are.
Oh,
New Zealand correspondent is there. And then they go off into a whole new wonderful world. Can you remember when you graduated for the first time from the University of Kent at Canterbury, William? Was it a case of slight apprehension, or was it just a case of, no, it was all part of the grand scheme?
Well, I remember walking out of my last exam and literally feeling almost physically all of the little knowledge I had falling out of my head through my ears. And I didn't bother to graduate. I didn't go to a ceremony. I didn't think I deserved it.
Oh, that's interesting.
So then you tread out into the unknown. The thing is not to have too many grand expectations.
Yeah, there is the cliche, because
if I look overqualified, don't want to be too overeducated.
Wait, it's balance. It's all to do with balance. There is the classic cliche, of course, of the graduation isn't really for yourself; it's for the parents. Yeah, that was the line, and I felt that as the graduation ceremony for London University graduates at the time was actually the Royal Albert Hall, still is actually. One had to actually go from that sort of perspective, but I can identify with what you're saying. Meanwhile, as John Brown Media and the world continues, we need to ask that question, because I know you couldn't answer it last week. Did you go to the wedding? Did you actually go to Pippa's Do? Was it there? Were you one of them?
You don't want to ask me questions like that. What's your next question?
Okay, then. In terms of the overall media coverage, is Pippa still going to be working with you over the next few months?
Oh, come on. Let's talk about something else.
All right, then.
Question
okay.
Three, Alex.
Question three. Will you be going to see Baywatch?
Baywatch?
Yeah, the movie's out there.
Watch it on the telly.
Exactly.
No, certainly not.
There is a movie with the possible next incumbent of the White House, Dwayne Johnson, taking the David Hasselhoff role, which was given a thumbs middling by Richard Fitzwilliams early in the production. And I thought, well, we might consider it.
I'd go and see Top Gun 2, but I wouldn't see Baywatch.
Is happening. It is official. Tom Cruise has turned around and said yes. He's getting together. There will be a sequel to the classic Top Gun, all of 1986. So 31 years ago since the joys of Tom Cruise and others sort of developed. It seems such a long time ago. And yet, in some ways, it's almost like yesterday, really. It's amazing.
Time flies by. Time flies, yes.
It literally takes one's breath away. But let's move on. What else is happening on Soho Radio these weeks? Because we haven't plugged your wonderful weekly show on Soho Radio, so I feel it's only right that, Siren FM, after all, we start with the same letter of the alphabet. Soho, how are things developing?
Well, it's very kind of you to ask. I still maintain that it is Britain's liveliest food and drink show on the radio. It's the only show on the radio that deals with this topic in a good, lively way, where we mix up-and-coming talent with established legends of the food and drink world, along with music. So, we keep plugging away. Soho Radio's had a bit of a refit. It's got a bit more space. Each week, I have my show goes live on a Tuesday morning. I can't remember who we had this week. a bunch of chefs. We were talking about... We had a bit of a gin special, Tom Warner from Warner Edwards, which is one of the growing band of British gin makers. He was in. He has a brand called Warner Edwards, which is made in Northamptonshire. Mm-hmm. They forage elderflower and they put rhubarb in their gin, which is absolutely fantastic, really delicious. So I'm about to get run over by a bin lorry. They were distilling gin live at the Chelsea Flower Show in one of their smaller stills, which is quite interesting. And you go in there and you get the juniper and the herbs together and you press them together in your hands and you get that amazing smell of gin. You realise that the gin really does take its smell from the botanicals.
Let's be honest, gin and sheep responsible for the British Empire.
Well, you say it like it is, Alex.
There you go. Another thing which also says it like it is the really quite good British cookbook. Let's spend a few moments talking about the really quite good British cookbook.
Well, this is selling gently. There's a North American edition, which is going quite well.
Say that with typical British understatement. According to Jenny Hartin, this is a stellar book and a portion of the proceeds go to a great cause.
Well, they do. They go to the Trussell Trust. Mm. And I think while we're celebrating all that's great in the British food world, the fact we do have a burgeoning food culture. There was a girl on my radio show this week talking about all the British cheeses that we have. She was a girl called Holly Chavez. I don't know whether she was related to the Venezuelan dictator or not, but anyway.
Did you not ask her, William?
Well, we did. Well, yeah, I said to her, how do you pronounce it? She said Chavez, like the Venezuelan dictator. I've completely forgotten what I was saying to you. Yeah, that's right. So, no, the point being that while we celebrate British culture, we have to remember also that food banks are alive and well and prospering, sadly, but they are amazing places. And they treat people who go in there as clients, and it's very heartwarming and moving to see it actually. And you'd be amazed, you go to some of those prosperous parts of capital cities and they have food banks. So the Trussell Trust is a charity that supports them, and we are supporting the Trussell Trust through proceeds of the Really Quite Good British Cookbook.
Excellent. Which presumably can be obtained through all the usual outlets online
The usual outlets plus the outlet of my own private bookshop. You ring me up, send me money, I send you a book.
I might sign up for that. Obviously, I can't be seen to endorse it in the sort of scenario of things, but I'm sure we can get something.
Of course, you're going to endorse it. Of course, you can endorse it. You mentioned it. You are endorsing it.
Oh, William, you're so
getting away from it.
Sometimes I feel, in the words of Greg Wallace.
Hello, this is Greg Wallace, and you're listening to William Sitwell on Siren. The man's far too posh.
There you go.
Can you be too posh? You can't be too posh.
Let's bring on Liz.
It's funny. You don't have things like you don't have jingles that go. You're listening to Siren Radio. And Greg Wallace, a man who's far too common.
Nice. But, you know, in the spirit of the whole system, he may want to have a right to reply there. Anyway, let's move on. I was fascinated by your little sharing of Frozen Charlotte, the creepy Victorian-era dolls that slept in coffins and were baked into cakes.
Did I do that?
That indeed actually came through from the Dangerous Minds archives, from that perspective, to which your response was, you're on it. Extraordinary. Maybe we'll just leave it until we get around to October and Halloween.
Is the sun shining in your village today?
Do you know, weather, highs of 25 degrees centigrade, lows of 14 degrees centigrade, another dry, sunny and very warm day in Lincoln.
Good. Well, make sure the people of your village put on their sun cream.
Sun cream is vital, and we've said that and we'll continue to go and saying it, particularly as we actually head towards the Lincolnshire Show, which is a matter of weeks away now, June the 21st and 22nd, and then magic will be ensuing. I'm really pleased, William, that we had the rehearsal this week to kind of map out exactly what we're going to say, how we're going to skip from the possibility of weddings through to Soho Radio, through to wonderful, august and important talks and tomes like the Really Quite Good British Cookbook.
And the importance of drinking British gin, and there are so many choices now.
Exactly.
That you must, if you're thinking about drinking gin, and gin is a wonderful drink, there are so many different versions. You don't just go into a pub or a bar or a supermarket and look for a gin with tonic. Yeah. You need to select your gin from the hundreds available, whether it's Heppel or Sipsmith or indeed Warner Edwards, then select your tonic, whether it's Fevertree and so on. And the other interesting thing we should talk about next time is Seedlip, this distilled alcohol-free spirit, which is about to hit the shelves, and that's an extraordinary invention, and remains to be seen how well it will do. But you know, people who don't drink need to feel they can have proper grown-up drinks, so maybe Seedlip is going to be another Fevertree in that it's a small business that makes a fortune.
That will be on our agenda. In fact, it already is on the agenda for 7 days, or 168 hours if you're counting, from now, William. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us today?
Reasonable, interesting, and today.
And we've already confirmed that hopefully you'll be back in, as we said, 1 week from now.
1 week.
Watch out for that aircraft, William. It's coming down by the bicycle even as I speak. The fact that the eyes are the window to the soul, it's clearly an astonishing notion that in the latest Vision of Britain report, there are potentially 9.8 million Brits who are at risk of losing their sight simply because they're not actually having their eyes tested regularly. And indeed, British optometrists have estimated that 50% of first-time patients are diagnosed for vision correction treatment, and 1 in 10 can be diagnosed with a medical eye health problem. Now, to begin to address this particular issue and hopefully begin to come up with some solutions, it's an ace individual whose blog alone is actually worth accessing in terms of Sarah says. It's a genius in every sense of the word. It's the legend that is Dr. Sarah Jarvis. Good morning, Sarah.
Oh, good morning. After that, I'm quite looking forward to hearing me speak.
Splendid. So, Sarah, let's just talk about this, because surely the stigma that used to occur when people said, oh, I don't like to use glasses, or I see glasses as not appropriate, it's an admission of guilt. I mean, in this society where we're supposed to be so concerned with our health, why are we so reluctant to simply get our eyes, which, as I said, are such a vital sense organ, tested on a regular basis?
Do you know, I really, really wish I knew. I have to say, the Vision of Britain report, which was produced by Optegra, really surprised me in some respects. We're doing quite well in some respects. We are better at going to seek help if we had a problem. But in the Northeast, 53% of people agree that sight is the most important of their senses. And yet, one in five of them describe their eyesight as being annoying. Well, given that the vast majority of them can get themselves sorted out by a simple visit to their optician, I have to say I find it extraordinary, especially when we see so many celebrities wearing glasses as fashion items. And indeed, my daughter actually wears glasses with clear glass in them because she thinks they look cool.
Well, it was good enough for Clark Kent, of course, so it should be indeed good enough for your daughter as well. But in terms of that, this notion of the beliefs that are there, the fear, has going to the optometrist replaced going to the dentist as one of those irrational fears where you think, oh, I just don't want to go there?
I don't think it's anything to do with fear of anything nasty happening, but you're absolutely right. One in four British adults go to the dentist more often than they go to the optician. I think it may be that a lot of people realise that if they don't keep their teeth in tip-top condition, then something awful is going to happen, and they know that they need to have a checkup. But interestingly, a lot of Brits don't appear to realise that there are so many visual symptoms that can actually be diagnosed without them knowing about them. So, for instance, 45% of people know that an optician can detect raised blood pressure, raised cholesterol, even diabetes, but the rest don't. An awful lot of people don't realise that eye problems may not cause symptoms in the short term, but if you get them checked and diagnosed, you could prevent disaster, and indeed you could even stop yourself losing your sight. And I think perhaps a particular shout out to parents, because 20% of parents don't know that eye checks for children should start for every child between the age of 4 and 5.
In terms of the mythologies that have emerged, are we still in the position where people believe actually if you feel that your eyes are actually and need some more help, eat more carrots?
Well, carrots do contain a bit of vitamin A, so actually there may be a teeny, 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 tiny amount of truth in that one, but not a lot. But interestingly, 47% of adults think, for instance, that contact lenses are uncomfortable. That's just not the case anymore. We've moved forward so much. More than one in three people think that a cataract affects your whole eye, so they may well be put off going to get help for it. And yet, actually, it only affects the tiny front lens of your eye, so it can be replaced in a remarkably simple procedure done under local anaesthetic almost within minutes. But for the ladies, rather than for the children this time, one of my big myths, I think, is that so many people think that eye makeup lasts forever. And I have to say, when I read these statistics from the report, I did sort of squirm a little bit. 79% of women do not check the dates on their makeup regularly, and they just discard it. They don't discard it.
Whenever we're doing one of our regular astronomy features, we always count saying you should never, ever, ever, under any circumstances, look at the sun directly, because clearly irreparable damage can be actually done with respect to that. But in terms of protection of vision, what are the best ways to actually sort of work into everyday routine, even if it's just a case of don't keep staring at a computer screen? Onwards and ever onwards.
Well, it's funny you should mention that, because of course 2020-2020 is always a really good one. Every 20 minutes, if you're working on a computer, look 20 feet away for 20 seconds and blink 20 times. That'll stop any irritation and reduce the chance of getting dry, gritty eyes. But in terms of tests that we really need to do, let's start again with the kids. 80% of what we learn comes from our eyesight. 80% is visual. So if you're not getting those checks regularly from the age of 4 or 5, you may well not realise that your child has an eye problem. They could really be losing out in terms of learning. Again, blood pressure, glaucoma, cholesterol, your optician can detect if you've got a problem with that. But let's go really importantly to glaucoma. A lot of people don't know about this. And glaucoma is a condition where the pressure inside your eyeball is raised. Now, it doesn't cause any symptoms in the short term, although gradually it can start to cause symptoms that you may not notice at first. The problem is, if it suddenly sort of boils over into acute glaucoma, you can lose your eyesight. The only way in the really early stages to know that you've got it is to have regular optician checks and to get the pressure inside your eyeball measured. If your pressure is raised, you will immediately be referred on. You can get it diagnosed and it can be treated with regular eye drops.
And returning briefly to the Optegra study, it was standard to find that 24% of those surveyed describe their current standard of vision as frustrating and 20% as annoying. Surely that would lead to the motivation of actually doing something about it. But
well, you'd have thought, actually, interestingly, people in the Northwest were not absolutely fabulous. About one in three of them said they'd be prompted to have an eye test by a reminder or a message from their optician. But if you turn that on its head, it means two-thirds of people wouldn't, despite the fact that, again, over half of them say their eyesight is the most important of all their senses.
And there we are. Dr. Sarah Jarvis with some fascinating and informative words of wisdom and advice there in terms of eye care, something that the doctor has been suffering from, our great Time Lord friend. Isn't that right, Doctor Who scholar extraordinaire in the Forest of Dean, Alan Stevens?
Hello, sorry, I was watching Judge Judy then.
Nice to see you sort of focused on the whole piece, which is always marvellous. So, in Extremis, I just thought it was Iron Man's armour that was called Extremis, or maybe it's Stephen Moffat borrowing another title to put into a whole new field the challenges. Now we are midway through the final season of Peter Capaldi. What did you make of it, Alan?
Yeah, they often, the thing is that they are quite strongly influenced by films and there are shows that goes on. I mean,
is it Doctor Who meets Dan Brown?
No, it's the strongest influence on the story, bar the obvious recallings from, you know, the Power of Elves and all those are stories they've done, is probably the Android Invasion, a Doctor Who story written by Terry Nation in 1976, I think. And it involved a race called the Krells, deciding they were going to invade a village, or, you know, as a sort of forward base on Earth, and they recreate the village down to the in the last blade of grass on their own planet, and populate it with androids, including android duplicates of the Doctor
and Sarah Jane.
And Sarah Jane, that's right. Yeah. So basically, it's a kind of rip-off, computer version, computerized Matrix-style rip-off of that, really.
Mm. So I take it wasn't really one of your highlights of the season so far, then?
Well, it was all right, you know. I mean, I wasn't bored by it.
Wasn't Robots of Sherwood?
Oh God, no!
Right.
No, that was. Well, I wasn't bored by that either. I mean, I think the worst thing you could say about the story is it was boring. Robots of Sherwood may have made you, you know, annoyed or feeling you wasted 45 minutes of your life, but it wasn't. It wasn't really boring. What story was? I don't know. It was entertaining. I just didn't find it was particularly. You know, new. It seemed like I was watching stuff I'd seen before, to be honest. And the idea that Missy is the person who's in the vault, you know, a lot of people have predicted that. And when I heard people saying, I reckon it's Missy or the Master in the vault, I thought, what a boring, stupid idea. And obviously it won't be. And then it was. So I can't say. It had kind of been spoiled for me, or not spoiled, because I didn't believe it, but when it turned out to be true, I just thought, oh, that's kind of like, you know, very boring, isn't it, really? So, you know, I wasn't massively inspired by that idea, really. If I'd have put something else in there, like, I don't know, anything, Apocalypse Device, Judge Judy, anything would have been better than the Missy, really.
Chameleon, perhaps? Just a thought.
Yeah, why not? You know, that's something. On the one hand, see the thing, everything that appears in the show, you know, this season or anything, has appeared before within the framework of a show. So, for example, they've got the 10th Planet Cybermen coming back. Now, you could say, oh, well, because, you know, Peter Capaldi is a fan of the 10th Planet Cybermen, and the very first interview he did, he said he would let the 10th Planet Cybermen come back, and obviously there's a link there. But also, when the Mark Gatiss Doctor Who special, but about William Hartnell came out in the 50th anniversary. It featured, a 10th Planet Cyberman. So you know, there's a kind of. Do you mean there's a kind of, you know?
If you wish for it, it will manifest itself. What has been will be before, and so on. And we go around in circles like a Cylon wondership. Anyway.
What?
I'm just sort of elaborating and riffing on the whole notion of the cosmos. Right. Bottom line, CaldorCity.com, still out there, still worthwhile accessing all sorts of details. Alan, I'm just astounded looking at time. We've already said hi to Gabriella Peralta in Gibraltar, Richard Fitzwilliams, clearly not impressed by Baywatch or indeed Snatched. Although Baywatch, he said, I don't know, are you going to be heading off in the Forest of Dean to check out the latest incarnation of Baywatch?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
The movie. You see, it hasn't reached.
We're making Baywatch a movie in the Forest of Dean?
It has been made. It has been done. You can go and see it now.
Well, funny you should say that, because I actually went and saw Alien Covenant.
Did you enjoy it?
Last night. Actually, yeah, I thought it was pretty good. I mean, I'd read a review of it saying that one of the characters in the film says, you know, I've no idea what's going on. And he says, yes, this is funny because no one knows it. It's obvious what was going on. Some reviewers are just thick, aren't they, really?
And some folk prefer to actually just say it's all too complex for my little mind because they're using inverse logic and inverse snobbery to pretend that actually they're less cognizant of the world than they actually are. But that's another philosophical debate which we can go into or not. Listen, next week, really exciting thing, Alan, because not only will you hopefully be joining us for Episode 7's review of the series of Doctor Who, but prepare the joys to be unstopping, unceasing. It will be World Milk Day. The Thursday, the 1st of June, 2017, is World Milk Day.
Right.
Yeah, I thought, I can tell you're excited. I knew you would be, so that's why I wanted to reveal it.
I would have missed that. It'd have been past me.
Yeah, exactly. And I set you up for that in a classic Benny Hill, Ernie, fastest milkman in the West way, and you delivered with aplomb, it has to be said. So, thanks to Richard Fitzwilliams, thanks to Ian Lennox, thanks to Dr. Sarah Jarvis and Neil Mapes and William Sitwell. Alan Stevens, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today?
Well, sure.
It has.
I learned a lot about eyes.
Well,
my father actually had his cataracts done. It was quite a life-changing experience because, you know, people don't quite realise, you know, your eyesight degenerates on a very slow basis. Eventually, you feel like you're looking through cobwebs. Mm. And so when you have the lens replaced, it is a, you know, his eyesight was back to how it was probably when he was in his 30s.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's always important to work through that. A little public service notion here, or important announcement that for Siren FM listeners, we'll be joining the rest of the country, of course, at 11 a.m. today, and our managing editor Andrew David will be hosting the minute silence in remembrance, obviously, of those who lost their lives in the tragedy and the attack in Manchester on Monday. So, Alan, we've already sort of confirmed that you've had a brief but hopefully reasonably satisfying and educational telephonic link with us. Can we guarantee that for World Milk Day, you'll be back with us next week?
Yeah, sure. I'll still be in the Forest of Dean.
I figured that would be the case, you see. I didn't even sort of think you'd be back in the Joys of Staines. I thought, no, it's the Forest of Dean number that will be there. And actually, we haven't asked you, what mark out of 10, I know you don't really like this, would you have given Extremis?
Sure. I've only watched it. I can't say I remember a lot about it. Probably.
You had the Pope in there. That was always quite nice.
Oh, yeah, the Pope turned up, didn't he?
Exactly. Yeah. Range of other sort of elements within the whole field. You have the...
Well, it wasn't the Pope, was it? It was a computer simulation of a Pope.
And that's always at the heart of so many confusions. When you step through that door, will you simply decompose? We say that with every presenter on Siren FM. You step outside the door.
Again, a lot of his stuff is taken. I mean, he was a big fan of Star Trek Next Generation. And a while back, I was asked to write an essay on one of the stories. And I started watching the show and decided I wasn't going to write one. But I'm not saying I thought it was a bad show. But the thing is, in watching it, I suddenly realized a lot of ideas that appeared in Star Trek Next Generation was then ripped by Stephen Moffat for Doctor Who.
Yeah.
And one of them, on the holodeck, do you remember when these characters convinced themselves that they were real and they walked off and suddenly they all fell apart?
It was Moriarty, ship in a bottle.
That
and
was it.
Data
it was,
and a whole range of things. And,
yeah.
And curious enough, Data is Sherlock Holmes. Maybe it's all just a holographic illusion, the entire Moffat oeuvre, whether it's Holmes
or
Sherlock.
It's all filmed in a film studio in Cardiff. But the thing is that... you know, you being a big Star Trek fan, I'm quite sure if you think about that when you watch an episode, think, yeah, this is a test for you. And when we speak next Thursday, say to me, I'd like you to say to me, I will say to you, Alex, did you notice anything in this latest episode which was stolen from Next Generation? And you will say, yes, Alan, yes, and you will tell me, won't you?
On that bombshell,
yes.
A cliffhanger ending in the classic Whovian tradition. Can you say bye-bye, Alan?
Bye-bye, Alan. The